in the 1990s. This happened at Princeton University with a scholar who was, or an alleged scholar who was hired to promote this denial project in the academy. I'm happy to say that so much good scholarship by so many scholars worldwide has so eroded and rebuffed Turkish denial that today Turkish denial is a laughing stock. The Turkish government is a laughing stock in the face of the rest of the world. And it would be so important for Turkey to move forward, to stop the denialism, to let go of this racist hate project against its ethnic minority cultures, including the Kurds today, to start embracing democracy, human rights, and diversity. The fact that Turkey has more journalists in jail than any country in the world over the last several decades, according to Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, tells us something. And so
we're going to have to leave it there. But Professor Balikian, we thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning Armenian-American poet, professor at Colgate University, his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Ozone Journal. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned natural foods cooperative featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a farmer's market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, hospitalizations in Oregon reach the threshold set by Governor Kate Brown to move counties into extreme risk. The Census Bureau announces Oregon will receive an additional seat in the House of Representatives, and the U.S. Department of Justice will investigate the Louisville police related to the fatal shooting of Breonna Taylor. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 26th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 780 new cases of COVID-19 on Sunday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 180,700. Oregon health officials also reported one new death, raising the state's death toll to 2,485 people. According to a New York Times analysis, Oregon now ranks first among the 50 states for where cases are increasing fastest, and it's third nationwide for where hospitalizations are increasing the fastest. There are currently 319 people hospitalized statewide, including 66 patients in intensive care units related to coronavirus. This means there are more than 300 people hospitalized, which Governor Kate Brown had set as the limit to keep counties out of the extreme risk category in her four-level system of restrictions. Now that hospitalizations have reached that threshold, it's expected that Brown will announce early this week which counties will move into the extreme risk category. 11 counties in the state, home to about one-third of Oregon's population, would qualify for extreme risk. New restrictions would take effect in certain counties on Friday. Extreme risk category restrictions mean restaurants and bars would have to close indoor dining, gyms and indoor entertainment will have to significantly reduce capacity, and social gatherings will be restricted. So far, more than 2.9 million first and second doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered across Oregon. At least 29% of the state's population has been fully vaccinated. All Oregonians 16 and older are currently eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 32.1 million cases of COVID-19. At least 571,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 58,000 new cases reported per day, a decrease of 16% from the average we saw 2 weeks earlier. So far, about 42% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 29% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 146.8 million people in nearly every country. At least 3.1 million people have died across the world. The U.S. Census Bureau announced Monday that after a decade of booming population growth, Oregon will get a new sixth seat in Congress. This is the first time in 40 years that the state will receive an additional congressional seat. According to the 2020 census, the state's population was 4.2 million. That's a 10.6% increase over the decade before. The increase, weighed against the slower growth or even population declines in other states, means Oregon will now have six members in the U.S. House of Representatives rather than the current five. Now that it's official, lawmakers face the likely contentious process of splitting the state into six districts. Currently, four out of the state's five U.S. House members are Democrats. Some observers have suggested that it's likely a new seat will lean Republican, but exact district boundaries are far from certain. Along with the new seat, the state will also receive one more Electoral College vote, bringing Oregon's total up to eight. Other states gaining seats this year include Texas, which will receive two more, as well as Colorado, North Carolina, Florida, and Montana, which are each gaining one. California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia all lost seats. In total, the U.S. population rose to 331.4 million, a 7.4% increase since 2010, which amounts to the slowest population growth since the 1930s. Community members, family, and friends of Robert Delgado gathered at Lentz Park in southeast Portland on Friday evening to remember Delgado, who was shot and killed by Portland police on Friday, April 16th. PPB identified the officer who fatally shot Delgado as Zachary DeLong. During the two-hour vigil, a crowd of more than 100 people gathered to listen to music, light candles, and hear family members share memories and speak about their grief. Delgado's family has called for a special prosecutor to investigate his death. At a press conference held earlier Friday, Delgado's family said they have asked Governor Kate Brown and Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate the killing. They also want Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt to consider appointing a special investigator to the case. Civil rights attorney J. Ashley Albies is currently representing Delgado's family in their pursuit for justice. The U.S. Department of Justice announced an investigation into the Louisville, Kentucky Police Department on Monday. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the investigation into the practices of the Louisville police a little more than a year after officers with the department shot and killed 26-year-old Breonna Taylor in her own home during a botched raid. Garland referred to Taylor during his announcement of the investigation, which he said will assess whether the police department, quote, engages in a pattern or practice of using unreasonable force, including with respect to people involved in peaceful, expressive activities. The probe will be led by the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, which will be assisted by the staff in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Kentucky. Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher said in a news conference today that he strongly welcomes the investigation and outlines the steps the city has taken to improve police accountability. This marks the second pattern or practice investigation announced by Garland's Justice Department. Last week, he announced an investigation into the Minneapolis Police Department following the killing of George Floyd. A Minneapolis jury convicted former police officer Derek Chauvin of three charges last week for his murder of George Floyd in May of 2020. But the story of accountability doesn't end there in Minneapolis. Favin Gerezguihar has more with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of the murder of George Floyd last week. The trial has not ended just yet. Chauvin will be sentenced on June 16th, after which he will have 90 days to file an appeal. Meanwhile, community members are demanding murder charges against the Brooklyn Center police officer who shot 20-year-old Dante Wright. Washington County Attorney Pete Orpett is in charge of the prosecution. Monique Colors Doty says, Orbit failed to bring a conviction in the police killing of her nephew, Marcus Golden, in 2015.
Pete Orbit is not competent to present any cases that are involving people of color and African Americans. He is not competent to understand the law as it should apply to us equally as it would to his white counterparts. And we've seen that he backs the thin blue line.
Orbit has a long history of donating his legal services to the Minnesota Association of Chiefs of Police. Colors Doty and others are asking the governor to turn over prosecution to Attorney General Keith Ellison. Community members continue to advocate for police reform. Kimberly Handy Jones says her son Cordell was killed in 2017 by St. Paul Police.
There's work to be done because Chauvin is just one out of so many murderous cops. And as a mother who lost a kid, it's hard to digest. Because soon as we can get one cop convicted, here comes another murder.
According to the New York Times, there was an average of 3 police killings per day throughout the Chauvin trial. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Faven Garazguija.
President Joe Biden's infrastructure plan includes $12 billion for community colleges that could in part fund more apprenticeship programs at community colleges. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Apprenticeship programs at community colleges are poised for a big investment under President Joe Biden's infrastructure plan. The plan includes $12 billion for community colleges. At a recent congressional hearing, members from both parties expressed support for targeting some of those funds at apprenticeship programs within community colleges. Shelly Hodgson with Clackamas Community College says it's important that this type of on-the-job training pays people for their work.
Supporting the workforce in that way and helping people gain that education while also helping them provide for their families is really critical and helps people stay in the job, in the labor market, really attached and engaged in the work, and will be critical to help us with infrastructure projects.
Hodgson says 13 of Oregon's 17 community colleges support registered apprenticeship programs. While the state has an extensive network of programs, Hodgson says it would be good if they could cover more types of work. She says most are based in construction trades.
We have the opportunity to really look at expanding into areas like manufacturing, information technology. There's a group in Central Oregon looking at an apprenticeship for early childhood education workers.
Hodgson notes there's also a lot of advantages to having apprenticeship programs associated with community colleges.
If you are an apprentice that is receiving training at a community college, you are eligible for all of the student services and supports that a traditional student would be eligible for: financial aid, advising, counseling, all those different pieces.
There are about 10,000 apprentices in Oregon. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A bill in the Washington State Legislature improves the tracking of sexual assault kits, reviews police officer interactions with survivors, and helps them navigate the legal system. For more on the story, we go to Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service.
Washington state lawmakers are continuing their work from past sessions supporting survivors of sexual assault. House Bill 1109, which has been delivered to the governor's desk, contains a number of measures to improve investigations into these crimes and track the backlog of sexual assault evidence kits. Democratic Representative Tina Orwal says the bill requires law enforcement to provide status updates for kits, which is especially important if there is a DNA match in the FBI's tracking system. Orwal notes serial offenders are responsible for many assaults.
So it's really important not only that we're testing, but we're really following up to identify some very dangerous offenders that have been in our community for some time.
Reforms in sex crimes law are a bipartisan effort in the Evergreen State. Republican Representative Gina Mossbrooker has been Orwal's partner on this effort over the past few sessions. Orwal says testing of the backlog of sexual assault kits should be completed by mid-2022. April is Sexual Assault Prevention Month. Orwal says the bill will also review officers' interactions with survivors. The reviews will help the state improve sexual assault training for officers. Orwal says the trainings need tweaking. For instance, helping officers with their wording when they speak to survivors is important. She says one charged word is alleged.
That is a word that's often used, but also can make maybe a survivor feel like they're not believed or they're being questioned. And so it could be something as simple as a word.
The bill also helps survivors navigate the legal system with help from advocates. But Orwell says the state's work isn't over and hopes to build on these reforms next session.
I do think a next step is to apologize to survivors after all the sexual assaults have been tested. Let them know that the system's been fixed and where they can get the resources they need.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for in-depth coverage of a rally for Micaiah Bryant, a 16-year-old girl who was shot and killed by police in Columbus, Ohio. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 46 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 68. Today in history, in 1954, polio vaccine trials involving 1.8 million children begin in the U.S. 1 year later, researchers announced the vaccine was safe and effective, and it quickly became a standard part of childhood immunization. Today, polio has been eliminated throughout much of the world due to the vaccine. The quote of the day is from American author and social activist Bell Hooks, who said, quote, "I will not have my life narrowed down. I will not bow down to somebody else's whim or to someone else's ignorance." Reveals disapproval of President Joe Biden's border strategy. Vice President Kamala Harris sets a meeting with the President of Mexico, and two vocal congresswomen spar over the Green New Deal. With more on these stories, we go to Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. President Joe Biden continues to receive poor marks for his approach to the southern border crisis, with 53% of respondents showing disapproval in a Washington Post ABC News poll.
We really need the White House to really get on top of this and really be able to manage the flow better.
Latino immigration expert Vanessa Cardenas says the influx is a cyclical issue that started even before Trump.
They have been for years suffering from corruption in the country, from COVID in the last year, and now from the hurricanes. So people are looking for safe haven.
Unauthorized crossings are at 20-year highs, with Customs and Border Protection on pace to take in 17,000 teens and children this month, slightly fewer than during March. Vice President Kamala Harris will meet virtually with Mexico's president next week to discuss the root causes of migration. Harris told CNN Sunday diplomacy is needed to address the situation and acknowledged it won't be remedied overnight. President Biden is prepping for a Wednesday primetime address to Congress. Just 2 days before his 100th day in office, he'll update Americans on his policy progress and make a case for his $2.3 trillion American Jobs Plan. The president wrapped his two-day virtual climate summit Friday with dozens of leaders pledging to maintain or advance emissions reduction goals.
The commitments we've made must become real. Commitment without us doing it, it's just a lot of hot air, no pun intended. You know, we must implement these commitments, accelerate them, and innovate and invest in order to reach them.
New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez applauded the Biden pledge to slash emissions in half by 2030. At a rally Saturday, she also touted the new Green Deal, which she reintroduced last week along with Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts.
It's a sweeping resolution that seeks to decarbonize our economy and pegs that timeline not to political convenience, not to when fossil fuel companies say that we should peg it, but for when the science says that we should peg it.
Yeah. Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene, a staunch critic of the measure, told rallygoers in Florida this weekend the proposal will tear down the U.S. economy.
It will raise our taxes. It will cause our energy prices to go through the roof, make us dependent on China for our vehicle needs, and it will make us a slave and lower us in the world.
On social media, Green claimed that Ocasio-Cortez had agreed to a House floor debate on the Green New Deal. Now to Louisiana. where Democrat Troy Carter won Saturday's special election for the 2nd Congressional District.
You deserve a voice in Washington, and I pray that I never let you down. I will never lie to you. I will never run from you. I'll always be available.
Carter replaces former Congressman Cedric Richmond, who resigned in order to serve as a White House special advisor. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
An Indigenous man wins a hunting case in Canada's High Court, and the deadline nears for the distribution of tribal coronavirus funding. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Supreme Court of Canada Friday ruled 7-2 in favor of a Washington State man who was charged with illegally hunting in Canada more than a decade ago. Emily Schwing reports.
In 2010, Rick Desitel crossed the U.S.-Canada border into British Columbia, where he intentionally hunted for elk without a license. Back in 1953, the last surviving member of Desitel's ancestral tribe, the Sinaixt, passed away in British Columbia. 3 years later, the province reclaimed Sinaixt lands, and Canada's federal government officially declared the tribe extinct. Desitel wanted to prove his people were anything but extinct. He was acquitted in 2017, but the province appealed twice and lost. Now the Supreme Court of Canada has sided with Desitel. Via Zoom, defense attorney Mark Underhill delivered the news to Desitel, his wife Linda, and dozens of other Sinaixt who had gathered to celebrate the ruling.
On behalf of Canada, welcome home. We won.
This is the first time the Supreme Court of Canada has interpreted what it means to be an Aboriginal Peoples of Canada. In the majority opinion, Judge Malcolm Rowe wrote that Sinaixt rights are protected by Canada's Constitution and that to exclude Aboriginal peoples who were forced to move out of Canada would risk perpetuating the historic injustice suffered by Aboriginal peoples at the hands of Europeans. Loggers, miners, and white settlers who moved into British Columbia in the 19th century proved to be hostile neighbors, and many Sinaixt were forced to move south across the border onto the reservation of the Confederated Tribes of the Colville in Washington State. Rodney Costin is the Colville chairman. He's also Sinaixt. He says his tribe will now work to protect cultural resources and sacred sites in Canada.
We will begin looking at our Aboriginal title back to our lands, our traditional homelands, and also, you know, that recognition that we do have rights as a First Nation in Canada.
Costin would not say for sure if the Sinaixt will seek reparations from the Canadian government. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Treasury Department faces a May 10th deadline for distributing $20 billion in federal coronavirus aid to tribal governments. The Mountain West News Bureau's Savannah Marr reports some tribal leaders have unanswered questions about the funding.
When last year's CARES Act funding was rolled out to tribes, there were pitfalls, including the formula used to divide the money up. It was based on outdated and incomplete tribal citizenship data, causing some tribes to be shorted millions, including the Eastern Shoshone tribe, according to its pandemic response coordinator, Karen Snyder. She says Treasury should have used the data that tribes self-reported.
We reported the actual enrollment of the tribe, and there was a disparity. You know, they should use really what the tribe's saying, because who knows better?
Eric Henson of Harvard University co-authored a policy brief urging Treasury to use that self-reported data this time around, and for the department to provide clearer spending guidelines and technical support for tribes as they make decisions about how to spend the money. Henson says tribes should also have the flexibility to spend it on things like housing and education improvements.
A lot of infrastructure investment could be really important here, because that's the platform upon which you can lift yourself up going forward.
Treasury has until May 10th to disperse the funds to tribes. It hasn't yet released an allocation formula or further spending guidance. For National Native News, I'm Savannah Marr.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A Nebraska farmer grows citrus all year round, and he wants to help others do the same. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Alliance, Nebraska, winters are cold and windy. But for decades, retired farmer Russ Finch has been growing tropical fruit year-round without an energy-intensive heating system.
We have 13 varieties of citrus, lemons, limes, tangelos, tangerines, you name it.
Finch heats his greenhouse with a geothermal system that takes advantage of the consistent temperatures 8 feet underground. He first experimented with geothermal energy 40 years ago when he was building his home. He devised a system that pulls air from underground tubes where it's 52 degrees Fahrenheit all year. It worked so well that he installed a similar system in his greenhouse. Fans circulate the air, but that's the only part of the system that uses electricity. So it's good for the climate, and he says the greenhouse costs less than a dollar a day to run.
We've taken the cost of energy completely out of the equation.
Finch is almost 90 years old, and he's still growing fruit year-round. And now he's helping more people do the same. He sells geothermal greenhouse building kits so other small farmers can grow citrus in the snow. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 26th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Faven Gerezgihar, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Imago Theater, presenting an interview with poet and playwright Drew Pizarra about his new radio play, The Strange Case of Nick M. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today on KBOO News in Depth, we will be listening in to a rally for Micaiah Bryant in Columbus, Ohio this past weekend. Micaiah was a 16-year-old black girl who was shot and killed by police on April 20th. Micaiah's family say she called Columbus police for help with a fight with girls in her neighborhood. Body cam footage from police at the scene show Micaiah holding a knife to defend herself against her antagonist, not the cops. About 10 seconds passed between when police arrived and when Micaiah was shot. This audio comes to us courtesy of Evan Davis and the Columbus Community Radio Foundation.
For Casey Goodson Jr., for Andre Hill, Deontay Bell, Tyree King, Jerron Thomas, Christopher Wade, Kareem Jones, Kwame Patrick, Henry Green, Jaquarius Robinson, and this is all just in Columbus. And there's many more names just from the past 6 years. That's only one portion of it. Today we are here to continue to lift up the life of Micaiah Bryant. We have her family here with us, and I'm gonna let her aunt, Myra, introduce the family. So we can make some noise for Micaiah Bryant and her family, please. First off, I just want to thank everybody for being here. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your dedication for justice for Micaiah. I'm sure you can imagine this is a tragic event. It doesn't seem real. You never think that it's going to be your family that's going to be impacted by something so big and so wrong. It knocked at our front door, and it's so unfortunate. We love Micaiah. Micaiah was with us. This is her grandmother. These are her brothers and her sisters. I'm her aunt. Even though she was in foster care many times, she was with us. She spent the night over at my mother's house. She went to school for my mother. She was with her brothers and sisters. We are the family that know and love Micaiah. I'm sure you guys have seen in the media, she loved music. She loved to do hair. She was an awesome cook. She had a heart of gold. Micaiah was an angel that we were blessed with to have for 16 years. And this situation didn't have to happen like this. The system has failed Micaiah on so many levels. There are so many different outcomes where Micaiah would still be alive. So thank you for your support. Thank you for being here. Justice for Micaiah Bryant. And Black lives definitely matter. Make some noise for Micaiah Bryant. So we all know that the system itself is what failed Micaiah Bryant, and it failed so many black youth and so many black adults, just the black community in general, but the system, from the foster care system to the judicial system, they failed Micaiah Bryant because she should be alive. She was a 16-year-old child trying to protect herself. And it's too often that we call the police for help and they make us the criminal. They criminalize and dehumanize us in our death. So, again, thank y'all so much for coming out today. And like, this is heavy, and this feels more personal than anything else because I am a black woman. I once was a black girl. And Micaiah deserved to live to adulthood, have a full life. She had a 5-year plan that she's not able to execute because she was executed by the police, and that's what that was. That's what you saw. Yeah. So for anyone that wants to continue to defend the police's actions, when he had many options, he had so many options. That's right. He chose the lethal option. He didn't save another person's life. He ended one person's life, and that's all he did. And that's all Nicholas Verita needs to be noted for. Enough is enough. Columbus, Ohio is not safe for black people. And we don't say that in jest. We say that because that's the reality in our communities as they fly over our communities with their choppers in the middle of the night, as they run through our neighborhoods and arrest us without cause and harass us. As even when we stand up for black lives, they harass us and target us. And it's not okay. Not at all. The mayor turns his head to it. City council don't say anything about it.
Come on.
And enough is enough, because Columbus, Ohio cannot continue to be overlooked when we're literally fighting for our lives out here. This is a genocide against the black community in Columbus, Ohio.
That's right.
And it's not okay. Micaiah, just like Tyree, should be alive today. Tyree didn't get to graduate. He was a 13-year-old child. And don't let video evidence, or what they want to call evidence, I don't need a video to know that she was a child and she deserved to live. I don't need a video to know that the police have continued to commit crimes against the Black community. I don't need a video to know that our lives matter. That video evidence that they so quickly pushed out is a part of their agenda to say, hey, we're the good guys protecting and serving. No, that wasn't an action of protecting and serving anyone. That was an action of an execution of a child.
It was a murder.
That was a murder. And he needs to be held accountable. Nicholas Reardon needs to be held accountable. He hasn't even been on the force for 2 years, yet he got his first body, which is a child. Micaiah Bryant should be here. Her family shouldn't have to suffer. They shouldn't have to join a club that no one wants to be a part of. These unexpected losses in our community does damage from the top to the bottom. It affects us all. And this is a national crisis, just like it's a local crisis. It's not an isolated incident. And this is why we ask for the defunding of the police. This is why we're asking for the abolishment of the police. This is why we are demanding the abolishment of a system that refuses to see us as even human.
That's right.
Because if you can blame George Floyd for having an addiction after you've seen a video of 9 minutes and 29 seconds of him being murdered, absolutely murdered, then yes, we have an issue. And we've been had an issue. And there's no such thing as reforming a system that is working exactly how it is supposed to be made to work. For the upper class, for the white upper class,
1%.
For the white upper class.
1%.
And it doesn't include any of us out here.
No.
Doesn't include Black and brown people.
No.
It doesn't include the poor who are trying to survive.
That's right.
And it didn't include Micaiah Bryant. Mm. And that's not okay. So the mayor wants to come out and call her a young woman. She was a child.
Exactly.
And it's enough that they adultify Black children and we're not even allowed to have childhoods and be kids and make mistakes. Micaiah Bryant should be alive.
That's right.
And that's what we need to keep saying. She should be alive, but she's not. So we have to, it's our duty as a community and as organizers to fight for justice for Micaiah and advocate for her. It is our duty as a community and as organizers to support this family. And a lot of people have been asking how to support them monetarily. They are actively working on that, and when I have that information, I will definitely share it, because this family deserves every dollar to support her, to support her funeral prices, expenses, to support the children and her siblings. She should be with her siblings right now. And this just really breaks my heart, because Tyree King was also a child. And he was never given the benefit of the doubt. And Black children are never given the benefit of the doubt. Never. And it's not okay. Say her name.
Micaiah Bryant.
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 So next we'll have Zach. He is a local social worker, and he also works with KIPP. For KIPP.
The whole damn system is guilty as hell. My name is Zach, and I'm a social worker. And when I say the whole damn system, I mean the whole damn system. Social work and the child welfare system are guilty as hell. Right now, there are over 400,000 children in the foster care system, and that system is letting them down. Micaiah Bryant was in foster care. Micaiah was killed by a system that was aware of the problems but failed to do anything. She died defending herself in a fight with former foster children, now adults, who lived in the same home. The argument was about chores and escalated very quickly, and her foster mom was not home to intervene. Her foster home was not a safe place for youth, and Micaiah had even shared many concerns with her family. Since November, there had been 7 calls to 911. Clearly, the home was in crisis. The youth in that home were not having their needs met and needed help. I want to be clear that I'm not blaming any single individual other than Officer Nicholas Reardon, who murdered Micaiah. I have so much empathy for people who volunteer their homes and lives to take in children, many of whom have complex needs and traumatic histories. I have so much respect for the Children's Services caseworkers who are overworked, overburdened, and underpaid. Instead, the system as a whole is to blame. I don't know the details of what life was like in that foster home, but 7 calls since November is enough for me to know that either the foster mom needed more support or the children needed a new foster home. Or maybe Micaiah's family needed more support to be able to, yes, for her to be able to stay at home with her family where she belonged. Yes. There are many children who are in foster care because their families simply did not have enough resources to take care of their children. And what happens? They get taken from their homes, sent to a foster home, and the state gives that foster parent money to take care of somebody else's child, when that child could be at home with their own family if the state just supported them. I think everyone here recognizes that the system of policing in this country is also guilty as hell and is responsible for Micaiah's death. But I've heard people say the officer was allowed to use force to defend another person. And to those people, I say that just because it may have been legal does not mean it was right.
That's right.
Expand your imagination of what is possible. Violence does not have to be met with violence. As a social worker, I have de-escalated so many violent situations with children and teens without anyone getting hurt. I once had a teen try to shank me, and everyone walked away from that situation safely because I recognized that behind that teen's violence was fear. Some of you may remember that in 2017, a student opened fire at Columbus Scioto High School. One of the counselors approached the shooter, encouraged him to hand over the gun, and sat and talked with him for a half an hour until he was ready to turn himself in. The counselor stood by his side the whole time. No one was injured that morning. I'll say it again, violence does not have to be met with violence. We can abolish the police and be safer than we've ever been.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The word abolition focuses on eliminating something, in this case, the police. However, the concept of abolition actually focuses on the presence of the things like community care and support, which actually make a meaningful difference in preventing crime. When everyone has access to stable housing, adequate nutrition, health and mental health care, an excellent education, and a caring community of family, friends, and neighbors, they don't need to steal or join gangs, and they have the skills to peacefully resolve conflict and control impulses. Of course, things will still happen. People will still get angry, and problems will still need responses. So what if, instead of cops who only speak one language, violence, we had social workers, crisis workers, addiction counselors, and other professionals who could respond? What if people could call to get help for themselves or for others without fear that somebody will be killed? Miles Jackson didn't need police. He needed a substance use counselor. Andre Hill didn't need police. He needed a mechanic. Micaiah Bryant didn't need police. She needed nonviolent crisis response. City Council has talked about investing money in alternative crisis response. They sent out a survey, they've held town halls, and they've talked a lot. They have a working group, but they have yet to commit to an alternative crisis response that does not involve the police. So I call on City Council to take action now. As you keep dragging your feet, the lives of Black folks and other people of color are in danger of police brutality, violence, and murder every day. Columbus is not safe for Black people. City Council, you already have blood on your hands from each act of violence committed by the police. How much more blood are you willing to collect?
Hi, everyone. My name is Destiny. I'm at a loss for words because this pain is so overwhelming. Micaiah Bryant was 16 years old. Say her name.
Micaiah Bryant.
Micaiah, as they call her, beautiful, was beautiful from what we've seen. Not to mention, look what she's done. Her life will not be in vain. When I seen the video, I reached out and I said, don't be discouraged, because we have to change the narrative. When we say she was failed by the system, I don't know how many of the social workers and elected officials are aware of D.O. versus Gleason, where she could have been in her home with a family member with the assistance, the same as a foster parent. Now, it is time for us to make quality changes, do away with qualified immunity, hold everybody accountable for their actions, including those that go to someone's house to discipline a child that's not theirs. I could tell from the conversation that I've had with her aunt and her cousins, and watching Don and looking at her siblings, your life is forever changed. And you will forever have support from mothers such as myself and the organizers that are truly this working in your best interest. Be careful. Be careful. I say that to say, with all this knowledge, it's the key for change. We can't keep doing the same things, getting the same results. The same results is he was scared. It's legal. We watched the man walk in and shoot 8 people. They grazed his leg and walked him to the car. They ain't even need a stretcher. So for you to say, and I understand his training, it's probably done on video. This is not no freaking game. So when they're out there doing their training and they consistently tell us they need more training, when the flock are they going to do it? Because right now we have a 16-year-old young lady who didn't want to be moved away from her family and continuously moved, not knowing what's the next family going to be like. She didn't know. But whatever her frustrations and discouragements were, she felt like she needed to defend herself. She was at home, or what was supposed to be her safe haven. Now, again, if we look back at the policies that have been in place since 2017, she probably would have been home. And it's called D.O. versus Gleason. And it stands with families who are having these difficulties. I know this is about Micaiah, but if Governor DeWine or John Kasich would have went ahead and adopted this bill, this policy that's already been in effect, maybe one of the other family members would have been able to keep their family together. So stop sweeping crap under the rug, because eventually it's going to spill out one way or another. One way or another, Micaiah's life mattered. Despite what we've seen on the video, we know that she was already distressed. They say police aren't geared to de-escalate. That's not true. We've seen the sheriff get shot and killed here in Columbus, Ohio, and they wheeled the suspect out in a wheelchair. So it's possible to not kill. It's possible. If they make 1,000 excuses of why they're afraid of us, well, let's get them really afraid. Let's vote them out. Let's get knowledge and start turning some of these keys to the door that they hold Take these shackles off our hands. Take your knee off our neck. Get your shackles off my feet and give us justice and peace. Micaiah's life is going to change more things than she probably ever imagined. And y'all get ready. Get ready. I don't know who I told that it's going to be a long road, but your life matters. And we're going to stand together forever. Y'all just got some unforeseen sisters by these circumstances. And don't nobody want this platform while they playing. They don't want this. Baby, there ain't going to be nobody that's going to walk in your boots. And they're made for walking. And you keep on walking. And Ms. Deborah, you keep on holding on to your family. Because this should have been something that should have been done before that. Because I know if it was my house, there is protocol in everything we do in life. And the protocol was not to call the mom or the foster mom, but to call for crisis. With this, I pray that we use the keys of knowledge to open up the doors and let the floodgates ring as heaven would want. Thank you. Say her name.
Micaiah Bryant.
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 All right, so we're going to start lining up so we can march, because the whole world needs to know, and the streets of Columbus needs to know Micaiah Bryant's name. And we're going to make sure that the whole world knows 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant's name. Say her name. Say her name. Say her name. Say her name. What do we want?
Justice.
When do we want it?
Now.
I said, what do we want?
Justice.
When do we want it?
Now.
If we don't get it, if we don't get it, if we don't get it,
shut it down.
My name is Heather Johnson. I am a community advocate.
So you've also been involved in the efforts to oppose police brutality, to impose police accountability, to get racial justice in policing and crime prevention and such here in Columbus. And that's, of course, made the news lately because of the latest police shooting. Tell us a little bit of background about, you know, the history of the movement here in Columbus as so far as you've been able to observe, especially recently.
So I started with, remembering about Trayvon Martin, Freddie Grace, Philandro Castro, just a lot of names. And so in Columbus, it's taken another impact on us because a lot of us don't know that we are in the top 10 city. Of police killing our children. We're in the top 10 city of the police murdering civilians, and always having like an officer involved incident. With that being said, it's not been highlighted. We just recently started getting traction, and I will start with Casey Goodson Jr. Within the past 6 months. And then that led to Andre Hill. There's one name that I'm forgetting. But then there's Miles Jackson, Micaiah Bryant, and all of them need to be uplifted. I don't understand why we are fighting, but I do understand that the system wasn't made for us. And when I say us, I'm talking Black people.
So there have been quite a few protests ever since the televised killing of George Floyd, since that video went viral. We had a whole month, maybe a month and a half, of continuous protests every day in Columbus, a couple of which at the very beginning resulted in some property damage, and unfortunately a portion of the population, armchair cynics, let's say, remember that and have long since forgotten the grievances that led to those demonstrations and made them necessary. Has it been a struggle both to articulate the demands of the movement, make that clear in people's minds, and to overcome those kinds of prejudicial obstacles?
Oh, yes. It's definitely a battle, especially when you are dealing with a system that doesn't believe in protecting Black people. Here in Columbus, as many strides as we have made, such as Mayor Coleman being the first Black mayor, Shannon Harden being the first openly gay city council president, and being able to be in the capacity to have inclusion and diversity, we've also slacked so much, and we failed our community. And our demands seem very simple. What we're asking for, and we stand in agreement with other organizers, are to make historical investments in Black people and communities, ensuring that Black kids have access to a high-quality education, for the needs to be addressed to the homeless crisis, and the need to remove police officers from dealing with quality of life issues such as homelessness, substance abuse, mental health crisis, sex work, and etc. These issues we're asking to be handled by trained counselors and professionals.
And, of course, this came to a head after the a whole season of protests following George Floyd, and then there were several other killings prior to Casey Goodson and Andre Hill, which led to the city council sort of tepidly endorsing a civilian review board plan, although that had to be passed by the Columbus voters to get any actual kind of movement on that. The mayor established a commission to draft the proposal following the legal mandate, and has now identified people to appoint to that review board, but it's held up because of conflicts with the police contract, I understand.
Definitely.
And in the meantime, though, what's the mood of the movement? Is everything just sort of on hold? Or I know there have been demonstrations recently within the last few weeks.
The movement is never on hold. We're always continuing to move in either a protest way. I know that you earlier asked me a question and I didn't hit on it, and it was about people's mindset and taste in their mouth for having demonstrations that look like riots. If your police officers are killing your children, killing people that you care about, upstanding citizens to the point where we can't bring Subway to our families, we can't talk to the police with a cell phone in our hand, we can't stand our grounds with a knife, we're unable to have access to medical care because police presence in hospitals, all of these are taking its toll. And I know people are tired of seeing people's streets being blocked. Well, we're tired of blocking it. And with no justice, it's no peace until you prosecute these police. And that's a big thing. The movement is important and it's continually moving. And the thing about it is that we don't get acknowledgement for our community gives. We do a lot in the community. There is a lot of us that work with houseless folks, such as me, and also making sure that people have access to getting somewhere safe. There's a lot of things that we do in our community because this is the support, this is who protects us, is our community.
That was Heather Johnson, a community organizer in Columbus, Ohio. We've been listening to sounds from a rally for Micaiah Bryant in Columbus over the weekend. Our thanks to Evan Davis and the Columbus Community Radio Foundation for use of their coverage. You have been listening to KBOO News In Depth. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.